This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, architects are being encouraged to incorporate features from traditional Pacific houses into their building designs, as researchers have found they are resilient to natural disasters and climate change.
Amazingly, I found that those traditional houses has got almost, I would say almost not all, but almost all the features.
Australians are being encouraged to support an Indigenous voice to Parliament, and campaigners say the issue might be divided on generational lines.
A lot of the responses that we get from young people is, why hasn't this already happened and why are we still having these conversations?
And there's a growing push to have Pacific knowledge included in higher-level talks around climate change and disaster preparedness.
Pacific Islanders need to be involved in the discussions around the solutions.
All that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, the United Nations says almost 90,000 people have been displaced by violence in Papua New Guinea's highlands. Tribal warfare has flared in several areas, and the country's election saw violence escalate between May and July. The United States committed almost $5 million in assistance, but humanitarian groups say more help is needed. PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reports.
In the midst of PNG's election in July, a tribal fight flared in Porgera in the country's highlands. Rose Whalen was among those forced to temporarily flee their homes and gave a harrowing account at the time.
Nights are becoming the worst. You hardly sleep. There's the gunshots going around, there's shouting, there's killing, there's war cry.
Months on, and tens of thousands of people across the highlands remain displaced. Ongoing violence in parts of three highland provinces escalated between May and July during the country's election. The United Nations now estimates 89,000 people have been displaced and 400 killed. Temba Kalua is the United Nations resident coordinator in PNG.
Women and children are the most affected. About 25,000 learners are unable to attend school as schools remain closed in the affected areas. About 70 women and girls have been victimized by rape, kidnapping or sorcery, accusation-related violence, and the number sadly continues to grow.
Serhan Akhtarprak from the International Organization for Migration says mobile teams are searching for victims.
We still see that families had been separated. Women had been sent to remote areas to stay with their relatives, and are still not feeling very safe to return and join the men.
The most recent outbreak of violence has been around the town of Goroka, where many homes have been burned down. That fighting was sparked by the murder of the CEO of the PNG Ports Corporation. Peace talks have started in some parts of the region, but things remain fragile.
Some people are in fear of coming out, as they are afraid of reprisals. Because it is not just a matter of seeking help, but also protecting themselves. There is, in some places, still an issue called manhunting is a matter of concern. People are after some others.
The United States today committed almost $5 million in additional assistance. It comes as the U.S. continues to increase its presence in the Pacific. Joseph Zadrozny is from the U.S. Embassy in Port Moresby.
Our presence in Papua New Guinea has grown. Our USAID program and staff has grown. And we will continue to partner with all of the countries in the Pacific, including Papua New Guinea here.
Justine McMahon from Care International says responders are working to safely deliver supplies to those who need them.
There's an urgent need for food and essential supplies. So this money from the US government will make quite a profound impact on the lives of people in that area who've been living in fear for about 4 months now.
But more help is needed. Even with today's announcement from the US and previous donations from partners including Australia, only 30% of the current appeal has been funded. PNG's National Disaster Centre has requested 10 million kina from the PNG government, or almost 5 million Australian dollars, but it's waiting for its delivery. This is Natalie Whiting in Port Moresby for PN.
That was a Natalie Whiting reporting.
Pacific Beat.
Hope you're having a lovely Tuesday morning. Thanks for joining us here on ABC Radio Australia. The Secretary-General of the Pacific Islands Forum, Henry Puna, is hailing an upcoming White House meeting with Pacific leaders as a landmark in U.S.-Pacific relations. For the first time, Pacific leaders have been invited to Washington to meet with President Joe Biden as part of the United States' efforts to re-engage with the region.
The upcoming meeting with President Biden on the 28th and 29th of the month in Washington, I'm pleased to say that as a result of our various advocacies, our American friends have heard our voice and have now extended an open invitation to all forum members. And so, you know, we will all be in Washington for the first summit between the U.S. and the Forum Island States. So that's an opportunity that we're all looking forward to. I believe that with the exception of the Premier of Niue, who is tied up with the ADB meeting in Manila right now, I believe everybody else, all other leaders, will be at that meeting. But the agenda, since it's being hosted, the summit being hosted by America, is still to be shared with the members. But we're sure and we're hopeful that it will be in alignment also with the various priorities that are set out in our 7 thematic areas in our 2050 strategy. But it's an opportunity that all leaders are looking forward to. And it's good, I think, you know, as a starting point, that America has heard our voice, taken on board our concerns and our requests, that when they engage with us, you know, they should engage with all of us. And so that's a wonderful start.
That was Henry Puna speaking at the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. And in advance of the Washington summit, the PIF Secretary General says Pacific leaders have already made some powerful statements at the UN.
I congratulate forum leaders on the very strong national statements at the United Nations. And I recognize that all leaders maintain the forum position on our priorities, including climate change, various aspects of security at both the regional and international level, and also reaffirmed our very strong position and support for Ukraine. The region also took the valuable opportunity to convene a global launch of our 2050 strategy under the leadership of the forum chair, the Honorable Prime Minister of Fiji.
That was Henry Puna, Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum, and the U.S. Pacific Summit that he mentioned will take place on Wednesday in Washington.
The big show is here.
Play the wraparound ball to Gutherson. He's over the 40, over the 30, Clint Gutherson scores.
The 2022 NRL Grand Final.
Comes left to Lenu. Spencer Lenu claims the try.
The Penrith Panthers versus the Parramatta Eels. Catch all the action live Sunday from 5:30 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia, your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
That sound means that it's time to find out what's making news around the Pacific right here on Pacific Beat. And to do that, I'm joined by reporter Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Priyanka.
Now, first, authorities have seized a massive drug haul in French Polynesia. What's that about?
Yeah, so a big opening story. So customs officers have confiscated 423 kilograms worth of cocaine, which was discovered in caches on the back of a sailboat, which was displaying the Swedish flag on Wednesday. So this was reported by French TV Info, and the two men on board have been placed into detention, and both of whom were of Swedish nationality.
And do we know where that boat, where that yacht was heading?
Yeah, so authorities allege the boat had come from Panama and was actually en route to Australia, where it was set to unload its cargo. Investigations are still ongoing, but the two men could be facing prison sentences of up to 10 years. It's actually the seventh sailboat that's been intercepted in recent times, confirming that, unfortunately, French Polynesia remains a bit of a crossing point for international drug trade.
Indeed. And now let's head to Vanuatu. Quite a tragic incident here. One dead and three people have been injured following a witchcraft incident. What's that?
Yeah, that's right. So this was reported by the Daily Post. And Vanuatu police have confirmed that five suspects have been arrested following the incident, which took place on the southern island of Tana. It's understood the death and injuries took place during a meeting between those involved, which was around perceived witchcraft concerns. The investigation remains ongoing, and police are urging locals to just stay calm and let them handle the matter. But it's pretty concerning stuff.
Yes, and now to some sporting news. Pacific Stars have potentially rubbed out. Is that right? Am I reading that right?
Oh, potentially being rubbed out.
Being rubbed out. Okay, that makes more sense. For Rugby League World Cup. Oh, what's happened?
Yeah, so Fiji's Tane Milne could actually miss the entire World Cup campaign in what would be a really big blow for the side. So he's been banned for six games following a high shot during South Sydney's NRL preliminary finals defeat to Penrith. So the hit was enough to get him a grade two charge from the match review committee, despite an early guilty plea. And that could actually be increased to seven if he challenges it. And unfortunately, he's not the only player in hot water.
Oh, dear. So who else along with Milne?
So the other is Tonga's Jason Tomalomu, who's been a household name in the NRL for a long time now. He's played for the All Blacks before switching allegiances to Tonga. But he's actually facing a three-match ban after he was sent to the sin bin while playing for North Queensland in his side's loss to the Eels in the other preliminary final on the weekend. So he was penalised following a high shot on Isaiah Papali. It was a grade two charge for dangerous contact. And he's actually since issued a desperate plea to the tribunal, hitting out at the rule which sees NRL suspensions cross over to the World Cup. So he says it could be his last World Cup playing for Tonga. He's 29 years old now. He doesn't know if or when he's going to play again, and he doesn't want to let his teammates and country down by being rubbed out for something he did playing NRL.
Oh, yeah, some desperate pleas there, but I guess it's not all over. They still have a chance to play in the World Cup.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I personally think his suspension's going to be upheld. I don't think there's going to be any getting around that. I saw the hit. It probably was a little bit of a bad one, but I guess it raises a different question as to whether, you know, something that happens in one competition should carry over to another competition. Mm. I personally think it should. I think if you do the wrong thing, it shouldn't necessarily, you know, mean that you can still play somewhere else just because it's under different, you know, under a different code. But yeah, that's just what I think.
Yes, but you can also feel what the players, you know, as we just heard, are feeling as well about potentially not playing in the World Cup. Interesting stuff there. Thank you, Kyle, for bringing those stories from around the region to us.
Thank you, Priyanka.
That was Kyle Evans bringing us, as always, as we always do these Monday or Tuesday mornings, it is, and every weekday morning, bringing us the news from around the region.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Indeed, you are listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Priyanka Srinivasan. And a new ad campaign to encourage Australians to support an Indigenous voice to Parliament has been launched. Advocates say that even though planning for the referendum is still in its early stages, the Yes campaign is about healing the nation through constitutional change. Wurundjeri man and member of the Uluru Dialogue, Roy Arcy, hopes the campaign has broad appeal.
We're reaching out again to the everyday Australians, the people that are that may not necessarily be engaged. However, you know, we put forward an opportunity for a transformation of the nation, and that's what this ad campaign is about.
And Bridget Thama is a Wurundjeri First Nations and Pacifica Fijian woman and a Uluru Dialogue delegate. She says younger generations will be crucial to getting the yes vote across the line.
Young voters are really, really important, and I think, well, I hope that this ad allows young people to see that they do play an important role in a successful referendum on The Voice. You know, the work that the Uluru Youth Dialogues have done so far is worked with young people from around the nation and really tried to, I guess, spread the word of the Uluru Statement from the Heart and particularly talk to young people about The Voice and what it means and what it can potentially do for Australia as a nation. So I hope that young people respond to this ad in a positive way and see themselves as a really important part of this momentous occasion in our history.
Why do you think younger people are the key here? What's different about younger people?
I think younger people are definitely willing to listen to First Nations peoples. A lot of the responses that we get from young people is, why hasn't this already happened and why are we still having these conversations? They're super keen to get it done so that we can move on to the next step of beginning to heal as a nation and looking to a future where everybody can thrive no matter who you are.
A survey this morning published in a major newspaper says 64% of Australians do support a referendum, but most people still don't understand what would change if it were to pass. Does that lack of understanding concern you?
I think the important work that we're doing is around educating and having those conversations, like opening up those conversations. And that's something that we also wanted the ad to do and to play a part of, is opening up the conversations about what The Voice is and what impact it will have, not only for First Nations peoples, but for Australia as a whole. You know, looking at the statistics that the Uluru Dialogue have analysed, we also find that people are more likely to vote yes than no when we have those conversations about what The Voice is and the impact that it will have in communities on the ground and also looking forward to the future.
Can you talk me through the ad that was released this morning and what it kind of shows us and how it targets the message to Australians? You know, being a radio platform, we kind of can't watch the ad, but can you explain it to me?
Yeah, so, as you said, the Uluru Dialogue have released our ad as part of our grassroots voice referendum campaign, History is Calling. And it's a really proud day for us. We're continuing to build on the momentum and the work that we've done earlier in the year. But as you said, this work has been going on for at least 5 years since the issuing of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, but around constitutional recognition of First Nations peoples for over a decade now. So this ad in particular is part of the education work that the Uluru Dialogue does, and it's about raising that awareness. But it tells the story of what a future might be if we all supported The Voice at the upcoming referendum. It gives hope, I think, of what the future could look like, but it also makes really clear that we still have a long way to go in this country until it becomes a reality where we can walk into worlds as First Nations peoples and get to the point we want to be. And so it does encourages Australians to take up the invitation of the Uluru Statement and for their support to get this done. And it really sends the message that together we can get this done. And you can see that in the ad, you know, different ages, people from different backgrounds, all having these conversations about The Voice and why it's so important that we get this done. And it's hope, really, I think. Ultimately, it is the Australian people who will decide whether this referendum is successful in shaping our nation's history. And we want people to be informed and confident going into the referendum. I think the ad tries to capture that. It tries to open up those conversations about The Voice and why it's really important, and also asking Australians to, I guess, take initiative and really get energised and support The Voice.
On Thursday this week, 50 people in the referendum working group will be meeting to discuss details of The Voice and also the timing of a referendum. Mm. Do you have any idea of what might come of that meeting? What are you hearing from the sidelines or from discussions with maybe some of those people who are attending that meeting?
I haven't heard any particular discussions, but I think it's a great next step that the Labor government have taken in setting up these groups. I think that that continues the really important work and adds to the work that we've been doing. It keeps the momentum going around heading to referendum, but I haven't actually heard any insight into what's being discussed in those groups as yet.
Was the campaign always scheduled to be launched today, or was it rescheduled after the death of Queen Elizabeth?
No, it was actually just timing around when we could get the ad done. We actually released our History is Calling campaign a few months ago now. So in terms of the ad being released, it really was just the right timing of when the ad was ready, and we had it in good shape that we thought truly represented the spirit of the Uluru Statement from the heart and what it calls for, as well as, I guess, that messaging of what the future might hold if we get a successful referendum.
And how else might we be seeing the Yes campaign targeting young Australians from here on?
So I think the Uluru Youth Dialogue will continue to do its work, and we have some really exciting opportunities coming up, activations on the ground where we'll be able to speak to young people around the nation, as well as some larger dialogue meetings where we're asking our non-Indigenous brothers and sisters to walk with us as well and get it done.
That was Uluru Dialogue Delegate and Wiradjuri First Nations and Pacifica Fijian woman, Bridget Tharma, speaking there with Newsradio's Dale Drinkwater. Hope you're having a wonderful Tuesday morning around the Pacific. You're tuned in here to ABC Radio Australia. And new research shows that traditional-style Pacific houses are more cyclone-proof than many modern designs. The people behind the study say some of these traditional features, like those found in Fiji's burés, could be included in newer buildings to make them more climate-proof. Researcher Dr. Mohamed El-Kaboutli says burés comply with a number of internationally recommended cyclone-proof features.
When I did the research in the cyclone-resistant houses, and this is the internationally accepted features or recommended features for cyclone-resistant houses, which recommends that the roofs needs to be hipped roofs with very small eaves, no overhangs, short walls, no openings or very small openings with opening protections, elevated foundations to protect against flash floods, as well as strong foundations, also recommended, and lashed connections. All the connections needs to have the cyclone straps or hurricane straps. So those were the internationally accepted or recommended features. So when I visited the village and did the observation, amazingly, I found that those traditional houses has got almost, I would say almost not all, but almost all the features. In terms of the roofs, I found it hipped roofs. In terms of the lashings or the hurricane straps, they didn't have the hurricane straps, but they got lashings with ropes, which is a natural rope they use, so all the connections were lashed. Eaves, naturally, they had very small eaves, which was only the thickness of the thatches. No overhangs whatsoever. We didn't have any overhangs. The walls of the houses were very short, per recommendations. And the traditional Fijian house did not have any windows as well. Only doors. It's got small, tiny doors that wooden doors could be closed and will make it airtight from inside. And the last thing was the elevated foundations, which most of the houses are built into on top of an elevated foundation, which made it stronger. Features I found in the traditionals that resembles the feature, the recommended features for the cyclone-resistant houses.
So that means burés are safer than some of the more modern buildings. So what are your recommendations? Do you suggest that people build more traditional-style burés, or do you recommend that they use some of those measures to incorporate into other types of houses?
Okay, I will start by a quote that I had from one of the elders in the village community. When I asked about the Buri, is the Buri safer than the normal or the contemporary house? And this was the quote that he told me, that the Buri will not kill you during a cyclone, but it will give you time to look after yourself. I'm not claiming that the Buri is going to survive, but it will perform better than other houses, for sure. And the effect on humans is not hazard like other houses. Because if we have a house with corrugated roofs during cyclone, this is a lethal weapon. So this might, you know, all the flying debris are hazardous. And there was a lot of incidents that those flying debris actually affects the populations. So my suggestions would be, but if we are going in nowadays to build houses, at least we need to learn from our traditions and from the traditional buildings, not to ignore everything. So we can learn all the features I just mentioned, and we can implement it in the new houses we are constructing. So this is number one.
How would that work? How would that look like?
As we speak, the people are building modern houses in the villages. So they are building, and there is no single design that they follow. So everyone can build anything. Anyone can build anything. But if you look at those houses, because I've been to those communities, they are not cyclone resistant at all. At all. Okay? Even they look modern. But let's say, if we go in this direction, if you are going to build a modern house anyway, so at least follow those features. If you're going to build a roof, make it a hip roof in a steep angle. Please do not put any verandas or overhangs. If you're going to have an eave, make it not bigger, not larger than 30 centimeters. Do not make large windows, because this, if breaks, you're going to break your house.
That was Dr. Mohamed Elkabutli from Massey University in New Zealand, speaking there to Dubrovka Volodar. Pacific representatives for the Red Cross are calling on the international community to bring Pacific knowledge into the fold of disaster management. It comes as, for the first time, Pacific representatives have been invited to an annual meeting on disaster risk reduction. Mackenzie Smith with this report.
With climate change an existential threat for the Pacific, the region's security was a critical part of last week's Asia-Pacific Ministerial Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction in Brisbane. Despite the Pacific being on the front lines of climate disasters, it's the first time the region's representatives have been invited to the annual meeting. Head of International Technical Services at the Australian Red Cross, Veronica Bell, says that's reflected in Pacific knowledge being absent from global approaches to disasters.
Climate change is having a significant impact on both the frequency and magnitude of the disasters that we're seeing, and that Pacific Islanders need to be involved in the discussions around the solutions.
Bell says one major solution is directing more funding toward disaster preparedness.
Over 90% of current disaster aid is invested in responding to disasters after they've occurred. So there's been a lot of discussion this week about how we need to tip that balance and start investing more upfront, supporting people to prepare for disasters, acting before they happen, and moving financing to that end of the scale.
The Pacific Disaster Risk Management Coordinator for the International Federation of Red Cross, Lemao Motusanga Afamasanga, says that work might include rolling out household plans across the region.
Preparedness is having a household plan, having a very articulated household plan that every person in a household is aware of what to do when there is a fire, when there is an earthquake, or when there is a tsunami warning, and understanding also that the science behind these warnings and being able to translate those into action.
She says one of the biggest difficulties is communicating complex threat systems to people so they know what to do in a disaster. Motusanga Afamasanga says investing in disaster preparedness could have a huge impact on how we think about threats facing the region.
We can then amplify the Pacific voices and say, look, we are no longer the most prone or the most unpopular when it comes to disaster risk reduction or disaster response. We are also the most resilient region in the world.
Motusanga Afamasanga is hoping aid partners will not only support the Pacific, but also learn from them in disaster risk reduction globally.
We are coming from a best practice and many, many lessons learned in the past decades. So it's not just us asking them to pay attention to us, but actually coming to the table with something very practical and very from experience-oriented, factual experience-oriented, to the global table.
JB Victorino from the Palau Red Cross Society says funding for disaster preparedness should also be going towards shelters and other infrastructure in at-risk communities.
All together, so that we can be more prepared before the big disaster strikes, a big typhoon or whatever, so that after it doesn't leave a huge amount of work for us, like recovery work. So I want that to be our aim.
He says the onus is also on aid partners like Australia to prioritise these efforts. Last week, the Australian government announced $9 million in funding for the UN Office of Disaster Risk Reduction, highlighting the risk Pacific nations face. But the Australian Red Cross is also calling on the government to improve access to study and work visas for Pacific nations to soften the blow of climate displacement.
That was Mackenzie Smith with that report.
Pacific Beat.
I'm Priyanka Srinivasan here with you here on ABC Radio Australia for your Tuesday morning. Aussie Rules is the country's biggest sport, and there's no crowd like one at the grand final match. And on Saturday, the 100,000-plus spectators at the Melbourne Cricket Ground were provided with a feast of entertainment at halftime, with a standout performance from Indigenous artists. One of those who took the stage was a Torres Strait Islander singer, Christine Anu.
Oh, I'm still pretty excited, actually. The buzz is real.
What is it like coming off the high of something like the weekend, being in the middle of the MCG with the entire crowd leaning in the way that they were?
We have to remember that this is like Melbourne's very first really big, you know, celebration after such strict regulations over COVID. And I don't know. We were watching, you know, the pre-match entertainment and just thinking, well, that's how you actually come out of COVID, people. It was big. It was sensational. It was wonderful. And it just it set the whole thing up. It was really, really wonderful.
A solo didgeridoo solo kicked off your performance with Emma Donovan. Then the band Goanna came in with Solid Rock. For you, what was that like? How important was it to be doing this?
Look, William Barton is hands down probably the best Yidaki player on the entire planet at the moment. His work it precedes him. His reputation precedes him. He's absolutely wonderful. Being a part of a supergroup, I've always wanted to be a part of a supergroup, but with the original Goanna band members, it was just absolutely such an honour. And look, I was in boarding school 1983 when this song was really huge in my life, watching Countdown and just watching those early years when Midnight Oil, in excess, Goanna were involved in, you know, concerts that were really quite remarkable, donating their time to promote, you know, awareness around Maralinga. So, you know, watching this band my whole life and then being asked to be a part of Goanna and then the AFL Grand Final, you just can't get a gig better than that, I think.
And given, I suppose, the complicated history of race and this particular code of football, why did you make that decision? Yes, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be in this moment. Does it change anything for you?
Yeah, long before anything comes up, like what's happening in Hawthorn and the AFL, I was already booked to do the gig, and I was booked to do the gig because, I was asked on by Shane Howard and the rest of the Guana band. That was the main reason for doing it. You know, like I wanted to be a part of the band, the song, representing my people. Because it's Goanna Band with First Nations supergroup, you know, wonderful representation of the up-and-coming emerging artists. It's the changing of the guard sort of like in that band itself.
Yeah.
And that's the way that they promoted it. And it's and Shane's got a long history with being an Indigenous ally and speaking up for the issues, the social commentary to do with the change of our mob. So it was really important that I stand up and be a part of the message that Goanna puts out there.
Yeah, I suppose what I was getting at with that question really was watching it, you were reminded of the power, the ability of sport to actually transcend some of the complex
That's
chapters
right.
that we've all lived or witnessed.
To go and put entertainment into that arena is spectacular, because we're making a wonderful statement about a lot of wonderful things, and that's the opportunity to do it through music. You're absolutely right. It does transcend all of the issues that are happening, and I hope that it was a moment to sort of come together and not ignore what's going on, but come together and celebrate music and each other.
So I suppose the other thing that a lot of people have been talking about was that unbelievable Robbie Williams performance at the start. Mm. Did you actually catch any of it?
It was just amazing. We were singing along, giggling, because he's really truly the consummate performer. He's amazing. He's funny. You know, he's singing one of his ballads and he's like, at the end of it, he's like, yeah, back to the hits now. You know, his dedication to Shane Warne, singing The Voice, and then John Farnham appearing on the screen. Oh, it's absolutely amazing. The choreography, the backing vocals, the whole thing was just so polished. Every single detail was extremely polished. And then Robbie, he's a funny guy. He's a great entertainer. And his songs, I was so intrigued that there was over 100,000 people, the largest crowd since 1986, singing along to Robbie Williams. It was goosebump stuff.
What is it about some performers that makes them amazing in a stadium of 100,000 people, while others can't seem to pull it off? You know, we all know the Meatloaf story. It hasn't always been so phenomenal.
I don't actually know about the Meatloaf story, but it is the story is, you know, it's like it's an urban legend. I think that with Robbie, those numbers are something that he's used to. He's used to performing like that. It's like practice makes perfect, right? He's used to that environment. And for others, like, it was some people's first time out in the middle of a 100,000 plus crowd. It's very daunting. I mean, if you don't leave your in-ears in and you are exposed to that electricity that surrounds you, which is quite palpable, it can distract exactly what you're supposed to be focused on for a second. I've done a lot of arenas and I absolutely know that it's quite easy to get distracted from what you're supposed to be focused on, because it's you can get caught up in the excitement and then, you know, it's all over, Red Rover. You know, it's you have to be seasoned enough to know how to handle that situation. And you learn. It's you learn by experience, I guess, Hamish.
That was a pop star and Torres Strait Islander singer, Christine Anu, who performed at the AFL Grand Final over the weekend here in Australia. And she was speaking there to the ABC's Hamish McDonald. And that about brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. And listeners, if you have any song requests, if you have a killer tune that you want to hear on Pacific Beat, particularly of local Pacifica artists, we'd love to have them featured on their song, on the show, and their songs featured on Pacific Beat. Please do get in touch. You can find us on the regular social media platforms. ABC Pacific is our handle on Twitter and Facebook. You can always also find me, reach out directly to me on Twitter. I'm on I Am Priyanka. That's @IAMPRIANKA. And a reminder, if you missed out on the top story of today, we looked at Papua New Guinea's tribal violence problem. The United States has committed almost $5 million in assistance, but humanitarian groups are saying they need more help to combat the problem. I'll be back same time tomorrow morning. Until then, have a lovely day.